Good evening from New York, and welcome to this NIAC Virtual Talks, Latin American Perspectives on International Arbitration, Necessary Responses in Crisis. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm NIAC's Executive Director. We're delighted to offer this program as we continue to shelter in place, acknowledging that we are slowly emerging in different phases across different jurisdictions. We're fortunate to again have so many of you on the line. It's really lovely to see delegates populating from across the globe, and our thanks to each of you for participating. Our journey today will involve five considerations: courts vis-a-vis alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, static and shifting norms, including default rules and new rules, a view on state-owned enterprises in arbitration, a view on commercial arbitration, and a deep dive into administered versus non-administered arbitration and innovation that lies as the anchoring force, in particular with administered or institutional arbitration. I'm joined by leaders in international arbitration known to many of you, and I invite you to review the delegate materials, where you'll find more detailed bios not only of the speakers, but also of their firms or institutions. I'll introduce by country as we head south from New York, noting that in several jurisdictions, we marry a practitioner's perspective with an arbitral institutional perspective to offer you a kaleidoscope of what's happening in the Americas. We first go to Mexico, and we have Silvia Samano Beristain, Secretary General at the Arbitration Center of Mexico, CAM. She is joined by Cecilia Azar Manzur, partner at Galicia Abogados. Next, to Guatemala, we have Paulina Rodriguez de Leon, associate at Consortium Legal. Moving further south to Costa Rica, we have Karima Sauma, Executive Director at the International Center of Conciliation and Arbitration Costa Rica, SICA, joined with AMCAM Costa Rica. On then to Colombia, we have Santiago Diaz Cediel. He is Head of International Arbitration at the Center for Arbitration and Conciliation at the Bogota Chamber of Commerce, CCB. And he is joined by Maria Camila Hoyos, counsel at CMS Law. Last but not least, we go to Chile. We have Macarena Letelier Velasco, Executive Director at the Center for Arbitration and Mediation at the Santiago Chamber of Commerce, CAM. She is joined by Liat Tapia Males, Senior Associate at Ugarte and Corea. I want to note my thanks to Michael Fernandez and Yesenia Vascones. They are the leaders of the City Bar's Inter-American Affairs Committee that joins us in co-sponsorship. In addition, I want to highlight the bounty of supporting entities that join us today. In addition to the institutions from which speakers hail, we are also supported by the Club Español de Arbitraje, CEA. Three global housekeeping points for all delegates. The session is being recorded. Please posit questions within the Q&A portal, and we will try to address in real time when posited, but as needed at the end of the session. And please review the suggested reading material divided by jurisdiction as a resource. Next, three notes on the program. First, we're lucky to have gathered a diversity of perspectives from leading experts on approaches to both domestic and international arbitration across Latin America in pandemic. Second, programs like this allow us for cross-pollination of ideas as we learn together, which allows us to transform with both resilience and ingenuity in pandemic. And finally, although each speaker hails from a noted firm or institution, the ideas each presents today is their own. Okay, we are ready. We are moving into the program in chief. We'll begin with a discussion about courts vis-a-vis alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And so the question posed is this: are courts available to assist with arbitration, including concepts of emergency and interim relief and award enforcement? Santiago, if I may, you're the first one to bat. Please share with us your perspectives.
Thank you, Rekha. I am delighted to participate in this dialogue, especially among such distinguished company. Colombia's judiciary was closed to the public between March the 13th and June 30. This was a result of Presidential Decree 491, whereby exceptional measures were adopted to regulate the continuation of essential services during the COVID-19 state of emergency, including the administration of justice. The presidential decree established only a handful of exceptions to the judiciary's temporary closure, mostly criminal and constitutional matters such as indictment hearings, petitions for a writ of habeas corpus, and other constitutional actions for the protection of certain human rights. High courts opened earlier, but the majority of courts only opened as of July 1st. Presidential Decree 491 expressly provided for the continuation of AVR mechanisms through virtual platforms and referred in particular to conciliation and domestic arbitration, among others. Perhaps it should be noted for clarification purposes that Presidential Decree 491 did not refer to international arbitration specifically. It only governed domestic arbitration, even though the term employed by the relevant provision in the decree is the generic arbitration, as has been confirmed by several members of the decree's drafting committee and by the decree itself, which only references provisions from the domestic arbitration section of Colombia's arbitration statute. For proper context purposes, it should be noted that when it comes to arbitration, Colombia has a dualist, so to speak, system. There are two different and often opposed sets of regulation, one for domestic arbitration and another one for international arbitration. In international arbitration specifically, there are quite a few matters in which the arbitration statute provides for judicial intervention and judicial collaboration in cases seated in Colombia. Local courts can be designated as appointing authority. They can also assist tribunals in taking of evidence. And of course, they can be asked to grant interim relief. I should probably note, however, that resorting to the judiciaries for such purposes is extremely unusual in Colombia. In fact, it has not happened in any of CCD's cases in more than 5 years, and perhaps there is only one recent, although not entirely related, exception, Council of State's decision of April on enforcement of an exit tribunal's decision on provisional measures. The impact, therefore, of the unavailability of local courts in these times of crisis has not been particularly significant for the arbitration community in Colombia. Annulment is the only legal action provided for in Colombia's arbitration statute against international awards. The case law of the Supreme Court of Justice in at least 12 annulment judgments since 2011 has been consistently friendly toward international arbitration. Judgments very much distinguish between Colombia's domestic public policy and Colombia's international public policy and clearly state that the latter is the only applicable standard when examining international awards. Colombia is a state party to both the New York Convention and the Panama Convention without having made any reservations. However, as it is the case with interim relief and others, not many enforcement nor annulment requests are presented before Colombia's judiciary ordinarily, less to say during these times of crisis. Even though courts were not generally available for dispute settlement nor for adopting measures in aid of arbitration during this COVID-19 state of emergency, Presidential Decree 491 presented quite an opportunity for arbitration, both domestic and international. In international arbitration, I should say it's been business as usual. In point of fact, not a single one of CCD's international cases was suspended during this period, And so I think it's safe to say there were no major disruption. 74% of international arbitration cases seated in Colombia are at ICCB. So this might give Reka some perspective as to how is the state of affairs in Colombia.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much. So let's move, Silvia. Can you give us the state of play? What's happening in Mexico as we look at the courts?
Yes, thank you, Reka. Good evening for everyone. I'm also very happy to be joining this panel and to share the experience in Latin America with all of you. And I'm seeing that there are a lot of friends and people that I know joining this event, so that makes me very happy. And I hope this will be very useful for all of us who are involved in arbitration to keep on going our effort to make arbitration really efficient and useful for people. So especially in Mexico, we have been on a 15-day basis actualization about what is going to happen with the judicial system. Regarding arbitration, we can access either the local courts or the federal courts. Now, currently, both are suspended. The one that is in the best scenario nowadays is the federal court, that they have already announced that starting on June 16th, people will start online procedures. However, not everyone has like the online culture or the requirements to have like the electronic signature to actually start the process. So it's good that now we have the option, but it's not that realistic yet. And I believe that the culture in general is not very open to start this kind of procedures. However, I believe that it's going to change in the near future because there is no other way to access justice if you want to go to the judicial system. And in the other level that I was sharing with you, that is the local courts, that's already announced that the court is supposed to open on August 3rd. So if you, in accordance to Mexican law regulating arbitration, you can request support from either of the courts. So currently the only option you may have is going to the federal court and to start your procedure in the electronic procedure. So that is the scenario that we have now currently. And I also like to highlight, as Santiago shared with us, the comparison regarding arbitration. As Santiago mentioned, that the international arbitration that they are administering in Colombia, also in Mexico, there are cases that are under the administration of Centro de Arbitraje de México have not been suspended. We have been rendering awards. We have in our procedure terms of reference. We have signed the terms of reference. We have even started some new procedures. So that is something very positive about the continuance of arbitration here in Mexico. Another difference that I found really interesting regarding to what Santiago shared with us is that in the pronunciations that the judicial branch have already issued regarding the continuance or not of the activities never refer to arbitration. There's no arbitration word like in never. So I believe that's good because the institutions we can keep on following without like really asking for permission. And parties have been very, very positive in order for the procedure to continue. But I feel it's very interesting how in other countries, the communications actually refer to arbitration. And in our case, we don't have that. Like, it's like the only reference that recently the judicial branch have made have been regarding mediation. They opened an online free mediation system that has been working for the last 15 days. I have no reference of how successful or useful it has been, but regarding arbitration, there's no pronunciation, no pronouncement. So until now, that's the reason why we can keep on working. But unluckily, when you want to ask requests for the courts, we are still like suspension until at least August, and we'll see how it's going to happen in real life.
So sticking with real life then, let's go. Karima, tell us, right? But we heard both from Santiago and from Silvia this idea of flexibility vis-a-vis ADR mechanisms, especially in pandemic. So can you tell us more? What's happening with gap filling where institutions are stepping in? And what are you seeing in region from Costa Rica and beyond?
Thank you, Rika. And thank you, Mike and Justenia. I'm so happy to be here with esteemed colleagues talking about these issues because, and I know some of my other colleagues are going to address synergy in greater detail, but, and this follows exactly what Silvia was saying. For those of us who have been actually able to continue administering arbitration or mediation processes, I think this is a time for ADR mechanisms to shine. And I really want to highlight that because I do think that ADR mechanisms have really risen to the occasion and adapted quickly to be extra useful in this time of crisis. And so we all know that ADR mechanisms have traditionally offered more efficient solutions than local courts in many jurisdictions, even before the pandemic. And the truth is that ADR mechanisms had also already incorporated technological tools for better processes, but they were also quicker to take this even further when the pandemic hit in response to the needs imposed by the crisis. And of course, we all know that not every dispute can be submitted to arbitration or to mediation or to other types of ADR processes. But I have seen in the context of COVID how we are being more creative and innovating in the ways that we approach and solve problems without the usual restraints of a judicial process. And so this includes the use of technology, including fascinating new platforms and gadgets. We've all seen the 360 cameras and all those stuff for witnesses, and those are great. And these are so useful to avoid interrupting arbitration and mediation proceedings and to overcome the challenges that we have now of social distancing. While most local courts, as my colleagues were mentioning, have struggled to provide to continue providing advocate services, ADR mechanisms have really been able to flourish in many jurisdictions. And that has been the case in Costa Rica. So for example, here, we have seen a huge rise in mediation cases, especially in those that are carried out completely electronically with virtual hearings. And this is a cheap and very efficient way for individuals and companies to renegotiate contracts and to look for creative solutions in times of great stress and in times of crisis, such as the one that we are now. So even though courts are able to assist with ADR cases, because here they are in a limited capacity, I do think that it is time for ADR mechanisms to show how truly innovative and useful they can actually be in these types of situations. Thank you, Rika.
Thanks so much. So next, Macarena, I want to turn to you. And if you can opine on, you know, we heard from Silvia, we heard from Santiago, but specifically Silvia underscored this idea of, you know, the courts are not open, but also the courts are not even referencing arbitration. What's the state of play in Chile?
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank all the New York International Arbitration Center team for supporting this opportunity to know about each other, what is happening in the different countries and in the centers. And it's so important, the relation that we are having today with the judiciary. The synergy between us must exist always, but even more is necessary during this time of crisis. In Chile, it was published a law in March, last March, that talk about the different suspensions of court terms almost in the evidentiary stage. But we have to go on, and arbitration and mediations have technology tools. But that's not enough. We have to have some relation with the judiciary, so we can go on with this process. Just to put in context, Camp Santiago was born in 1992, But in 2013, since that time, we had a modern digital platform of arbitration and mediation process. It was called ICAM Santiago. I will tell you more about them later. But that was one way for us to sign an interconnection agreement with the judiciary system of the Republic of Chile. And what role does technology play in this synergy between the center and the judiciary, even more in these times? We have a simple, a fast, flexible, a security manner to be in contact because we need the judiciary during the process and in many parts. For example, in an arbitration proceeding, we cannot leave, as I told you, aside the domestic judiciary system. We know the involvement of national courts in domestic and international arbitrator is essential to its effectiveness before, during, and after the commencement of the arbitration procedures. Someone told one time the court's primary statutory duty is to ensure that the parties can resolve the dispute before an independent and impartial arbitral tribunal without delay. Before, why we have to be in touch with the judiciary before the commencement of the arbitral proceedings? National courts have the task many times on enforcing the agreements in our cases. And during the arbitration proceedings, too, because the ruling about the competence of the arbitral tribunal in domestic and ad hoc arbitrations, because we cannot talk about just institutional arbitration cases, but to is necessary at the end of the arbitral process, too, because they have to enforce the arbitral award in many times. And I would like to talk about the collaboration between Santiago Arbitration Center and the high courts in Chile. Because you know that if we have had not this agreement today, we would like to continue the process. We have the technology tools, we have the video conference, but we need the judiciary. And now we are in our house, we can go to the office, we can go to downtown where the judges are. So this interconnection between the center and the judiciary has been so important. You know, Chile is a very arbitration-friendly jurisdiction, but CAM Santiago has worked a lot during many years to have a solid, a healthy, and a sound relationship with the judiciary. And we challenge more domestic CAM cases. Awards are upheld by domestic high courts of Chile. We need them to look through the claims of the resources that are against these awards. And today we have this interconnection. So we don't need to go to the high courts with the file, with the physical files. When any party needs some pronunciation of the judiciary of to know about a claim, we have different ways to connect each other. Email, but not just email. We are connected like just another judge in the court. So it has been a very good experience. But you know, you have to work this relationship. We have to win the respect of the judges of the high courts. And now, if you talk to them, they just told us, well, when we see a case that comes from the center, we know that is the transparency, the confidentiality, that the good faith, impartiality are part of that case. So this relationship with the judiciary, we have to work on that. We have to maintain it and look for it day by day. Today, we can tell you it has been a wonderful notice, this agreement that we signed 3 years ago. But today, in this time of difficulty for people to access to justice, we can go on to the arbitral and mediation cases online, but with this good synergy between the center and the judiciary. I invite you to work on this because I know sometimes takes years, but when you have it, it's a wonderful tool, not just for the centers, even more for people that are involved in our cases.
Thank you so much, Macarena. Well, there you have it as well, a call to action. Our work is not finished here. Indeed, we are just beginning as we learn how to deal in pandemic. We're now moving to tranche 2 of 5. We're talking about static and shifting norms. We're going to talk about ad hoc, default, and new rules. And so with that, if we could start out, Cecilia, what's the state of play on ad hoc arbitration, default rules? Share with our audience.
Sure, Rekha. Thank you very much. And thank you, Michael, as well. I'm very happy to be here with all of you. Karima, I really loved your sentence about the moment for ADR to shine. I agree. And I think we have to work on that direction. I love your sentence. So in terms of ad hoc arbitration, essentially when parties don't agree on having an institutional arbitration administer the proceeding, the arbitral tribunal will take on these administrative duties, as well as, of course, resolving the dispute. So this might impact in the time of the arbitration, because the arbitral tribunal will have to take care to both the procedure and the administrative matters, and, of course, resolving the dispute and analyzing the merits of the case. So an important moment of the ad hoc arbitration proceeding is the constitution of the arbitral tribunal. It's a delicate moment. And usually the parties will have agreed in their section, in their dispute resolution clause, how to appoint the arbitrators. Absent such agreement, or upon resistance from a party to follow the agreed procedure, or to willingly participate in the appointment of the arbitrators, court assistance will be necessary. And of course, the type of assistance, the time frame from the court will differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In Mexico's case, we have a unicentral model law type of arbitration law. So the cases of judicial participation in the arbitral proceeding, in the arbitration proceeding, are specifically determined in the law. And this is one of the cases. I mean, the appointment of an arbitral tribunal in an ad hoc case is one of the specific case set forth in the Mexican arbitration law for assistance of the court. And in that case, first, attempt to reach an agreement between the parties, and the absence of such agreement triggers the proceeding before the court. So first, the judge will hear both parties in terms of their opinion for the constitution or the arbitral tribunal. Then the judge might consult with one or more arbitral institutions, Chamber of Commerce, the names of available arbitrators. The judge may rely on lists and even forward the list to the parties, unless the judge deems that it's inappropriate. And finally, the judge will require the potential arbitrators to disclose any circumstances that might give rise to justifiable doubts on their independence and impartiality. So that would be like the very general procedure before the court in terms of appointing an arbitral tribunal in an ad hoc arbitration. And just a couple of words on default. And here we are talking about the case when a party fails to participate in the arbitration, in the arbitration procedure, and unless otherwise agreed by the parties, and in the absence of proper justification, if the respondent does not file its answer to the claimant's brief, the tribunal may continue with the arbitration. And even when a party does not attend the hearing or produces documentary evidence, the tribunal may continue the proceeding and render an award on the existing evidence. Of course, that doesn't mean that claimant will prevail in the arbitration. Still, the tribunal will have to hear the parties, I mean, claimant or one of the parties, will have to analyze the evidence, to analyze every one of the argument and render an award. So in this case, in my opinion, the arbitral tribunal will have to put extra care in due process, in the notification of every stage of the proceeding to make sure that the arbitral proceeding is conducted in compliance with the arbitral principles and with the arbitral rules. So to make sure that the arbitral award will be valid. So those are very general words in terms of ad hoc proceeding or and defaulting arbitration in accordance with Mexican arbitration.
Thank you so much, Cecilia. You know, we talk about ad hoc because as we go around the globe, we fully appreciate that we tend to focus in on arbitral institutions and administered arbitrations, but there is quite a culture of ad hoc as well, not only in Latin America, but around the world. And so to not limit ourselves to only administered, but indeed we are heading that way, so stick with us. The other comment that I wanted to invite our speakers to talk about is this idea of new things we're trying in pandemic. We talked a little about efficiency, but the other side of that is delay. And so I'm going to ask Liat to start us off, but really give that practitioner's perspective. We'll go from Liat to Maria Camila to back to Cecilia, and to talk about what is it like to deal with evidence.
Thank you, Rekha. Good afternoon, everyone. It is a real pleasure to be here with all of you. So thank you very much for this invitation. And coming back to Rekha's question, Chilean Congress enacted an emergency law to regulate how the tribunals across the country will function during the state of emergency declared by Sebastián Piñera, our president. In a nutshell, this emergency law gives judges and arbitrators the power to suspend the proceedings when the due process may be affected. Nonetheless, Article 6 of this law imposes the suspension of evidentiary terms. In other words, a procedure will be able to continue until the point it reaches the evidentiary term, and then it will be suspended. So an interesting question here is whether the emergency law applies to international arbitration, and if so, whether the parties may agree to avoid the suspension and present their evidence with their memorials or during the evidentiary term. Regarding the first question, as the emergency law refers to arbitration with no distinction between national and international arbitration, it is reasonable to believe that the law will apply to both domestic and international arbitrations seated in Chile. And regarding the second issue, and as a matter of practice, some domestic arbitration have continued on the agreement of both parties. Some of them have gotten suspended on request of one party based on this emergency law. And there have been arbitral tribunals that refuse to pursue the proceedings, even with the agreement of the parties, due to public policy considerations. But the picture in international arbitration seated in Santiago is very different. In preparation for this webinar, I contacted several arbitrations and counsel to gather their experiences. And even though they recognize some delays due to the pandemic, none of the procedures have been suspended based on the emergency law so far. So the situation remains more or less business as usual. Of course, some of the parties have agreed to suspend hearings or to extend deadlines due to restricted access to evidence or just because they don't like virtual hearings or they are not used to virtual hearings. But in these cases, no party has invoked the emergency law. And when I asked arbitrator what would they do if a party refuses to continue with the proceedings based on this emergency law, many of them have recognized that it will be difficult for them to continue with the proceedings, as they don't know how the Court of Appeal will interpret this emergency law. And just a final note, as Macarena mentioned, Chilean courts have shown a friendly approach towards international arbitration. They have interpreted the concept of public policy in an international sense so that the annulment of arbitral awards is less likely to be granted. For example, the Court of Appeals has ruled that local procedures rules don't apply in international arbitration, and that they will annul the award only for serious departures from basic rules of due process. And taking this into account in this context, I find really unlikely that our courts would set aside an award if the parties agreed to continue with the arbitral proceedings.
Thank you so much, Liat. So next, Maria Camila, if you could weigh in, and for full disclosure to the audience, Maria Camila is a Colombian lawyer, but working right now in Portugal. And so what are you hearing in country in Colombia?
Thanks, Reka. And I echo everyone's excitement of being here. I think that the situation in Colombia is most definitely different than it has been in Chile. And I just want to remind a couple of things that Santiago had already mentioned. So judicial activity in Colombia was suspended from mid-March and has just recently resumed past July 1st. And on March 28th, the government issued Act 491, according to which arbitration should continue. And again, just another reminder, Santiago already mentioned this for the case of Colombia. We have a dual system. This means that the set of rules that govern domestic arbitration is different from the one that governs international arbitration. So what changed with this act? First of all, we do have, some people have called this discussion, as Liat was mentioning, on whether the act refers to arbitration in general or only domestic. What it's true is that the actual effects of this debate are essentially none, because once again, the rule was just to go business as usual. And in terms of what was really regulated, it was only in terms of domestic arbitration. And I want to give a little bit of detail there. So Act 491 basically granted more time for arbitral tribunals to issue awards, 2 more months, and for parties to mutually consent in suspending the proceedings by 30 days in addition. And it, as much as it did order for arbitration to continue, it also brought 2 important exceptions. And once again, be reminded that I am talking about domestic arbitration only. And this March 28 Act simply said that parties should raise whether they have a technical impossibility to continue the proceedings or if they have an impossibility to produce evidence or attend hearings. And it's the arbitral tribunal who should make the decision at the end of the day. But the reason why this March 28 regulation seems to be so pro-arbitration, if one might say, it's because in reality, this only bolstered a framework long before the pandemic, and this I'm speaking 8 years or even more, depending on the rule that you're referring to, which already allowed in Colombia to go virtual, both in arbitration and I should add also in civil procedural law. So also in preparation of this webinar, similar to what Liat did, I also ran a couple of interviews just to have a sense of a little bit of a benchmark. And I just want to share with you my takeaway. So again, international arbitration, things have been kept pretty much business as usual. There is a consensus among practitioners that the March 28 regulation did not touch international arbitration. And there have not been significant delays. And also just an acknowledgement of the enormous effort that the arbitration centers have put in just continuing business as usual, including, of course, the Colombian Chamber of Commerce, where Santiago is affiliated. Now, in domestic arbitration, it sort of changes slightly, and I want to go into detail there. So it seems like many proceedings did stop in the beginning of the declaration of the state of emergency around mid-March. And I think it accounts for the fact that this March 28 regulation, as I shared before, by default just granted some extra time for the party. So it seems like people just took advantage of this while they were just accommodating logistically, like I guess we all did. But as of early June, it seems like activities have resumed. And I guess if there's just a takeaway from this, if you just want to have like a reminder of what's happening in Colombia, is the importance of having existing regulatory framework. And this is of course a personal opinion, I think that the arbitration statute was issued in 2012, and you know, when it was drafted, it was already envisioning the possibility of going virtual. So what changed? Some people say nothing really changed much. Again, this was just like a sort of tap in the back to the legislation we already had in Colombia. But I do want to believe there is actually a shift of paradigm. In a way, the Colombian government told the parties, the tribunals and the centers, you know, before you could go virtual, now you should. And I think that with that, I finish my talking points, Reka.
Thank you so much. So to Cecilia, if you could also come back to this discussion and weigh
sure.
in. And there was a comment post that I'll just also give you, this idea of documents only arbitration. Is that a way to sort of move things forward as we talk about efficiency?
It is, when it's possible. It depends on the evidence provided by the parties, because if you have an expert witness report, if you have a factual report, you might need a hearing to be able to cross-examine the expert or the witness. So it will depend on the type of case. But of course, the parties might assess whether they can agree on an arbitration based on documents and make it faster, of course, and more efficient. Now, in terms of the last weeks or the last month, in my experience at the firm, is that regardless of the existence of new rules, parties are now more willing to negotiate different aspects of the dispute. And even if they are already in an arbitration case, in an arbitration proceeding, they are more willing to agree on some aspects of the proceeding or to avoid some delays, etc. I mean, there are we can notice some tendency to settle, to reach agreements both on the merits of the case and in terms of the procedure. I have also noticed something very interesting in terms of some clients feeling that filing for an arbitration case right now, it's kind of politically incorrect. You see what I mean? That we are facing a complicated moment in the world, and filing for a dispute might be politically or commercially or even humanitarily incorrect. So it's interesting because that might change, of course, once we see that there is no other way to go. But yes, I have seen some clients feeling that way. Of course, this is different in terms of disputes against the state. In Mexico, we are facing a complicated moment in terms of a new type of administration, changing the legal framework in different sectors and undertaking some complicated measures in terms of commerce and the economic activity, and in that case, taking the or making the decision to file a claim or to go to arbitration against the state is different. In that case, I don't see that twist in terms of strategy, but between private companies and between companies, I have seen that way of acting or way of thinking that I find interesting.
Thank you so much. So we're actually going to go off that small reality of state-owned enterprises. I say that it's a niche within our commercial international narrative. And so how is that different, right? What are issues therewith? And we're seeing within the chat commentary that's being posited about we need to be cautious as we go to virtual, due process concerns. And so, Paulina, can you weigh in? What's happening here?
Thank you, Rekha. And before I give an answer to your question, I just want to give a little bit of a context of what it is to have a commercial arbitration in Guatemala when there's a state or the state department or state institution involved. Usually, these types of arbitration are ad hoc arbitrations. It's common to find these types of arbitrations once dealing with the state. And this leads the parties and the arbitral tribunal a more broad discretion in order to decide how the process is going to be taking its course. So during this pandemic, what I have experienced is that the state does raise objections regarding the conference call or the exchange of emails regarding when we are discussing, we continue the process by virtual hearings. And usually the objection that the states raise is the due process objection. And to give some examples, the due process objection that the state gives is that they need that the arbitral tribunal guarantee the parties the confidentiality of the platform in which the virtual hearing is being heard, the confidentiality of the data of the parties involved, and also they require that the arbitral tribunal guarantees the parties that all of the parties involved have a good level of connection of internet, which is a really a difficult thing to guarantee for the arbitral tribunal. So the objection of the due process has led to the phenomena of the due process paranoia that everyone in the arbitral community is familiarized. And I, for the ones who are not that well familiarized, I just want to read out loud the definition of the due process paranoia in the 2015 Queen Mary International Arbitration Survey. And it is defined as a perceived reluctance by tribunals to act decisively in certain situations for fear of the arbitral award being challenged on the basis of a party not having the chance to present its case fully. So in Guatemala, this due process paranoia has led arbitral tribunal to take the decision to not continue the arbitration by virtual hearing until the pandemic is over. So what I have identified is that the arbitral tribunal have led to this decision because it's common that there can be two risks. The first risk may be that the state or the state institution may promote or file an constitutional action of amparo based on the fact that the tribunal decide to continue the arbitration, albeit there is an objection from the state. And I want to introduce this topic of the amparo because for the international clients, sometimes it's a topic that is not well received because in Guatemala, and I believe that in a lot of countries of Latin America too, the intervention of the judicial power by constitutional actions are really common. But the problem we have in Guatemala is that for an amparo judgment to be binding, it takes at least from 2 to 3 years. So basically, your arbitration is over once you have a final judgment of amparo. So in my experience, I haven't seen during this pandemic an amparo promoted by the state precisely for this topic I am discussing of the time frame. And also because the probabilities of obtaining a provisional action of amparo are really low. And the second risk that I have identified as a reason why the arbitral tribunal decided to not continue with the arbitration by virtual hearings is because there can be a possible annulment of the award based on the due process ground. So in my experience, what this have led is for parties to agree that they and get into an agreement to waive the right to file an annulment based on the fact that the hearings and the process continue to be by virtual hearings. I have experienced only this with private entities, but I'm confident that within the time we will be having this type of agreements with the state. And this type of agreements have been really useful to dismiss the due process paranoia and demonstrate that thus that types of objections are not the sufficient valid. And I just want to end up with a conclusion that I know we'll be discussing more today, is that arbitral tribunals are empowered to base direct the due process rights, but also against the expedient conduct of the arbitration. And I believe that that's a really tough decision for the arbitral tribunals, but that's the job they take. So I think we need arbitral tribunal to take that into consideration.
Thank you so much. You know, as we move to our next two speakers to weigh in on this and what is happening in country, due process is a large term. And so, you know, I really thank Paulina for defining it within the Queen Mary Whiten case report context. Consider also how you ally arguments we do as lawyers with elements of force majeure. Does that tip a tribunal to find in our favor or not to move forward on hearings? But I'll pause there and move to Maria Camila and Silvia. Can you weigh in with that context of state-owned entities and the like that Paulina has given us? What's happening?
Well, if it's okay, I can go first. In terms of arbitration with states and state-owned entities, there's also no change in Colombia, again, as a result of my benchmark. And once again, I should remind that, you know, the call from the government was to continue arbitration. However, of course, the due process concern has been, you know, very topical in Colombia as well. And also because in Colombia we have the amparo action, which for those of you who do not know, it's a constitutional injunction. But I think there is something that we arbitration practitioners are missing in the paranoia, as Paulina, I think, properly labeled this. And it's that courts are also going virtual. So I understand the concern under business as usual. But as I was just mentioning, in Colombia, courts have reopened as of July 1st with lots of limitations. But, you know, even, I mean, I understand Colombia has this framework pre-pandemic and the like. But even so, I think this is just an invitation for practitioners to sort of stop being so incredibly risk-averse and sort of realize where, in which context it is that we're having this discussion. I honestly believe that the due process concern should be the rule of thumb for every arbitral tribunal. However, I think we should need to stop thinking that going virtual, let alone, is gonna be a basis for due process concerns. I think due process concerns will come as they would come otherwise. And if this is, of course, something that I believe should call for a little bit of peace of mind for all of us. And I just wanna add something else, which I found incredibly interesting from this benchmark. And with this, I conclude. As I was sharing with you, in Colombia, there is this dual system, right? So in domestic arbitration, it is actually the possibility for a delegate of the Attorney General's office to be a part of domestic arbitration when the state is involved. And what I have found also incredibly interesting and encouraging is that even during the virtual hearings, this delegate has been present in the domestic cases that involve states. So I might be incredibly optimistic, but I do think that we need to see the whole picture in context. And I do think, by the way, that courts will also take this into consideration. Courts will not make decisions on due process on a vacuum. They will also think about all of the incredible effort they had to do to continue administering justice. And just to basically repeat what Macarena said, you know, a couple of interventions before, I think that more than ever, we need to just be close to the judicial branch, be close to the ministries of justice in our countries, and make sure that this is just actually done, a community building endeavor.
Thank you. Silvia?
Thank you, Reka. I I agree with Maria Camila's comment in just make having like a more objective perspective about how worthy or actually convenient maybe to have procedures online, that it's not something that is totally different or that there's something that we are not used to. We do it all the time. We have like online interaction every time we will make bank transactions without like just like common stuff. So maybe we are, I agree with like over exaggerated with the due diligence. And regarding the position that an state-owned company may have regarding keeping up with virtual hearings, in my opinion, we have to keep in mind that this situation is extraordinary. Eventually, it will end. So maybe as an arbitrator, if the state-owned company says like, oh, I cannot participate, I have no internet, I don't have my computer, I don't have the file, whatever. Okay, that's temporary. Eventually, it was going to end. And once we all restart our activities, the state-owned company cannot keep on saying, I cannot do it. So this has been for the last 3 months. Maybe it can be understandable, but at some point, they have to keep on. So that's the only situation that I believe we have to keep in mind. In Mexico, there has not been like presidential decree that says that we cannot move or that everything stopped. Actually, it's each federal entity is like taking their own initiative, but like eventually we are going to go back, and the companies cannot have any that argument anymore. I believe that at some point there has to be like there's going to be a situation that it's going to change, and that will not longer be an excuse. That's my opinion.
Okay. We're shifting now to talking about commercial arbitration, domestic commercial, international commercial, what's happening, are cases moving to virtual? And so Santiago, if I may call upon you first, tell us what's happening in region.
As I mentioned earlier, Colombia's international arbitration regulation has not been subject to modifications during the state of emergency. And to be quite honest, our international arbitration cases have not seen that many changes during this COVID-19 era. This probably has not been the case for domestic arbitration, although disruptions at first sight appear to be less significant than in other jurisdictions, as Maria Camila rightly said. Many of our cases, international arbitration cases, already have a considerable amount of remote/virtual hearings and components beyond actually hearings. And so for our users in particular, it has been to a considerable extent business as usual. Before lockdown began and before the president declared a state of emergency, several arbitration institutions, including CCB, had already moved forward with implementing ways for conducting 100% remote hearings and remote proceedings. The structure, procedure, the legal and the organizational tools of international arbitration proceedings have also seen zero disruptions. The arbitral statute was rarely used as applicable procedural law in institutional arbitration, where CCV's international arbitration rules and the antitrust rules were and are still far more frequently used. CCV's international arbitration rules, which were inspired by the antitrust rules, included a number of procedural advantages in terms of use of technology in cases, such as expressly providing for certified email communications for remote hearings, including participation of expert witnesses, and even international arbitrators by video conference. Also for a fully virtual written face of the proceedings with no physical hard copy is required. And I think this is very interesting, for the e-dispatch and e-notification of awards, also with no physical hard copies required. CCTV's international rules expressly provided for the possibility of not holding on-site hearings. And in fact, before various other institutional rules were amended to reflect it, parties were expressly allowed to agree not to hold hearings at all As to the COVID-19 state of affairs, perhaps it should be said that CCV made a very conscious policy decision not to suspend terms nor stay any of the proceedings when the crisis emerged and lockdown began before Presidential Decree 491 was even drafted, rather choosing to expand the capacity of its remote platform and providing all of the ADR services by 100% remote mechanisms. In point of fact, I should say that arbitrator appointments, evidentiary hearings, preliminary hearings, and deliberation sessions have been held during lockdown remotely with parties and arbitrators from North America, Central America, the Caribbean, Asia, Europe, and of course, South America with no setbacks. CCV's platform guarantees both the integrity and the confidentiality of the proceedings. And aside from deploying all of the safety and integrity recommendations commonly available through different video conferencing platforms and other arbitration platforms, additional measures such as assigning a CCV tech person and a CCV staff person to monitor the meeting or the hearing in real time, aside, of course, from legal counsels and other assistance, has proven, Rika, to be very useful.
You know, just to underscore for everyone, arbitral institutions in modernity have updated their rules that many of the elements Santiago points out, you're seeing echoed across the world at leading arbitral institutions, including with the institutions represented on this panel. The truth of the matter was it wasn't always embraced, be it by the parties or the arbitrators in advance. And, you know, maybe it takes pandemic to get us to realize that we have all of these tools. So turning to those tools and what party and arbitrator reactions are, Karima, what are you seeing with respect to arbitrators? Do you find that they are encouraging the process moving forward in virtual? What are commentaries you're hearing from the parties?
Thanks, Rika. And this is a very interesting question. And as many of my colleagues have mentioned, at SICA and Costa Rica, we also sought to continue all our ADR services without interruption. We did work electronically before the pandemic, but the novelty came in managing all of our hearings in a virtual format as well. And one topic that I think is very interesting in the context of your question is the human one, because not everybody is accustomed to using technological tools. So as Maria Camila was mentioning, there are due process concerns, but there are also very real limitations in terms of skill and in terms of how much trust some people have in these tools. And our experience has been that some tribunals have really jumped at the chance of having virtual hearings, are thrilled, they are well versed in how they work, and have the confidence in their skills to use them. Whereas we had a few tribunals where the tribunals were generally composed of older arbitrators who were wary of VC platforms, had no experience using them, and really just expressed concerns in taking this approach, and especially with the participation of witnesses. So there's all this hype, and we talk a lot about how we are able to conduct virtual hearings and not interrupt our services. But at the same time, I think that the conversation has been ignoring very real concerns and impediments that come from some of the most essential participants in an arbitration, which are the arbitrators themselves. And this technological gap is something that we're trying to actively address. And so, well, we came up with a somewhat creative and temporary solution to this while we train all our arbitrators and while they gain more firsthand experience with these tools. And since our physical offices are closed because we are all working remotely, in those domestic cases where the tribunal does not feel ready to carry out a virtual hearing, we implemented a happy medium between a physical and a virtual hearing.
And so this entails having the members of the tribunal, counsel for the parties, and the witnesses all in different rooms at SICA. And so they're all connected via our VC platform, but they're all in our premises and they're abiding by the guidelines imposed by the Ministry of Health. But they are still there, especially because of the issue with the witnesses that I think is what concerns the arbitrators and the parties the most. And so this solution has provided great comfort to everybody involved, especially those concerned with undue influence and with due process concerns. And it's also at the same time helping tribunals to become better acquainted with technological tools and has helped us continue smoothly with our processes without interruption. So it's a work in progress, but I think it's a good solution while we bridge this technological gap.
You know, towards the technology learning trajectory, I've also heard actually where due process concerns are involved. Those who are on ADR platform teams have said they've sent the 365-degree camera and the witness hits it, turns it off. And then what are the due process concerns that become very real because there is a lack of monitoring or a lack to verify witness coaching, for example. And so we're all learning. And, you know, the question to the institutions in general has been, will arbitrators be encouraged to update their CVs to demonstrate their adeptness with online platforms? But Macarena, please tell us what you're seeing in country and in institution.
Thank you very much. Well, as many of you have talked before, I think we were working in these online platforms since a couple of years ago. And this pandemic part of the history has just let us know the tools we have to go on in the procedures, arbitration procedures, and mediation. And I just want to tell you that international domestic cases in our center, the 95% has continued. We have had more than 400 video conferences. And of course, it's more difficult when we are talking about witness, but we have had a first hearing, for example, when the parties with arbitrators agree the terms of the procedures of the cases, many conciliations hearings, but we have had two witness hearings too. And I think we have to work on, for example, good faith between the parties is so necessary in these times. And the balance between celerity and due process is so important. Last year, I had the opportunity to go with Mauricio Gonzalez of CCB of Colombia to UNCITRAL meetings, and there they were talking about this, the celerity procedures and this paranoia of due process of law that is really important. I think we have to look always for the due process of law, but today we have to go on with these technology tools because our life, since we wake up in the morning, is with a lot of technology in the bank operations and in infinity things today. Learning in online is part of our life, of our children's lives. So I think we have to go. And as I told you, since 2013, CAMP Santiago has this modern electronic processing system. So our arbitrators have worked on that with electronic sign in many for the resolution of the awards. In CAMP Santiago, I can tell you, is an electronic platform that enables digital processing and provides support to the parties, to the arbitrators, mediators, and lawyers. You can have remote access to the participants. And if we think what is going to happen after these times, the difficult times we are living today, I think the technology is just going to be with us for the future. And that is a good notice. But we have to go on and look in many things that can go against due process of law, of course, but we have to be very clarifying about the advantages of these procedures. To reduce cost, remote access to digital files, transparency, celerity, and maybe we are working in trusting each other, because someone told me days ago, but Macarena, what is that the witness have someone in the room and the arbitrator can see him? Well, but we are in arbitrator cases, arbitration, the owners of the cases are the party. And if they agree to go on with these tools, well, and the arbitrator is okay with that, maybe we have to trust each other and look this opportunity of changing the way we work in these cases. They are big cases, but we have to trust each other. Electronic notifications are security, confidentiality and protection of information. We have to look about them too. And all these take us to the interconnection with the judiciary. You can download manuals to know how to use these tools. And you know, and I would like to talk a little bit about the pro bono programs that in these times we can have, for example, mediation online. Many people that need access to justice today can have it because they can go with the cost of arbitrators of arbitration, or they have suspended the terms in the judiciary system. But justice is, we need justice every day. And if we are going to wait until a normal times get now into our nations, into the world, maybe that justice that get too late is not justice. So let's go on with this technology tools. Let's put on the table the good faith between each other, lay trust in the system, but be careful of due process of law because it's so important for everyone.
Thank you so much. You know, as we get more institutional perspectives in general, I wanted to just give Silvia a moment also to weigh in on what's happening. We sort of covered the gamut, you know, moving into how arbitral institutions are resilient, what's happening. And so in general at CAM, what are you seeing in Mexico?
Our experience has been that, as Karima shared with us, everyone who is involved in the process has been very proactive and very accessible to keep on with the procedures. The arbitrators have been very accessible and willing to just keep on going with the process, as well as the parties. And I would also like to make a similar comment to one of Macarena's regarding the support or the improvement that the institutions may give to ADR, as they did in CAM Santiago with the programs of online of pro bono mediations, specifically in the Arbitration Center of Mexico. We have issued a program for reducing the cost for arbitration for the next 6 months. So there's that's the initiative of the institutions in order for making ADR, as they are, we all know they are so efficient, so useful, but now we want to make it the most accessible as possible. So that's the attitude we are having at the center. We are committed with ADR. We are convinced that it works. We've seen it. Now we want to make people to actually try it and have the experience and having at the end a solution for the controversy.
Thank you so much. Karima, do you want to tell us too at SICA new things that you all are offering to revolutionize, as many of the institutions are?
Sure. And so I think somebody also mentioned, we just issued a new rules in February. So they came out with perfect timing just before the pandemic. And so they actually have an expedited procedure that's aimed, it's really low cost, that's aimed at small and medium enterprises. We implemented the virtual mediations, which was something that was prohibited in Costa Rica before. And so that's something that we worked with the Ministry of Justice while once the pandemic hit, that there, so that there was an authorization. Costa Rica is a highly regulated country and everything. So that's also something that we had to look for. And actually, once we got that authorization, we've seen the mediation cases just explode because it's such an easy way for individuals and small companies to have a cost-efficient way of solving their issues. And we're waiving fees for those small and medium companies in those cases as well. So the idea is to help them survive the crisis and not be part of a problem that will just shut down commercial relations between companies.
And the note on expedited arbitration, that's very helpful because, you know, a hot topic, obviously, at UNCITRAL, many of the arbitral institutions have had it. The question then becomes, will the parties use it? Will they embrace it, much like other delineated items where administrative rules are very helpful? That's pushing now to the practitioner's perspective and sort of to get Cecilia and Paulina to weigh in. You know, we keep talking about this dichotomy, efficiency to due process, reliability of virtual platforms. And so what are you seeing in your practice? Are the cases moving virtual? Are they being suspended? What is the overall sort of climate of proceedings?
Sure. Thank you, Rekha. Very, very quickly, because we want to have time to see or to answer some of the questions from the audience. Jump in. In my experience, parties are moving forward with the hearing probably late 2020 and probably 2021, first semester of 2021, and of course analyzing whether the hearing could be moved from a traditional style to a virtual one, and whether they can, as I said before, agree on some topics and narrow the dispute to some other that must be conducted in the arbitration. So I have seen that a tendency and that willingness from the parties to agree on that and to conduct the arbitration in an efficient manner. In terms of administrative cases or ad hoc cases, I'm a strong believer in the institution role in arbitration. I think in countries like Mexico, the benefit of institutional arbitration is very clear, and I think we have to keep close to the institutions, to the local and the international institution. I have seen a very interesting the initiative from CAM, for example, offering a new schedule, fee schedule for the rest of the year in cases low. I think Silvia is less, it's between 1.5 million pesos and 5 million pesos, and CAM is offering a new fee schedule for those cases and a new set of rules. Providing the parties with a fast-track arbitration. So I think we have practitioners, institutions, and the judiciary work together in order to offer the companies and people in general alternative to manage the cases and to conduct the cases in an efficient way. I strongly recommend everyone to take a look to the ICC guidance note on possible measures and at mitigating the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. The ICC guidance that were issued in last April, because they provide with a very interesting set of recommendations in terms of how to face this situation. As dispute resolution practitioners. So that's a very general comment, and I'll be very happy to answer any question from the audience. And Paulina, I don't know if you want to add something else.
Thanks, Cecilia. And I just want to point out a comment in the chat from Marlon Mesa, that he says that he has the impression that there are more suspensions of proceeding than cases moving virtual hearings. And I agree with him, actually. I don't know if it's because that's how it works right now here in Guatemala. But in my experience, arbitrations that are being administrated are moving forward. And I believe that it's because the center does an active offering of continuation with the process, but also there's a huge cases going ad hoc that the arbitral tribunal does not have the infrastructure to provide the parties the option to continue by virtual hearing. So regarding the innovation of the centers, what I have seen during this pandemic is that arbitral institutions have been offering for ad hoc tribunals their services in order to provide them the platforms to film the audience, to transfer the hearing to the parties, to record it. So I think that now we will be seeing a more part of the arbitral institutions in a more active way. And I think that it's a good way. And it's also something to take in consideration right now when we are drafting arbitration clauses, to think if actually the ad hoc proceedings are still the best way to go on, or if it's better to have an arbitration institution that administers the arbitration in order to have all the elements necessary for the proceeding to move forward.
Okay, thank you so much. So we're gonna take very briefly, if you'll allow us, we'll extend by 5 to 10 minutes and just take two questions, commentary of which has been coming up in the chat. And I'm going to pose it generally to all speakers. The first is this dialogue on the PROG rules, you know, soft law that can fill in gaps. Does it alleviate the need or the argument towards due process concerns? What are their application? But, you know, in general with soft law, what are you seeing? Is it helping to address some of the concerns that parties are having, especially in pandemic?
Well, I just think that the concerns are more like in a practical nature than something that has to be regulated. I think it has to do with, I think Macarena mentioned that people are worried that the witness is going to be, there's going to be undue influence on the witness, or there's problems with connections, or there's going to be people involved who shouldn't be involved in the hearings. Or, I mean, these are all aspects that can be formally regulated in soft law or whatever, but it just comes down to the good faith aspect of the process and how the parties conduct themselves. So I think we could have all sorts of regulations, but I don't think they would address those specific concerns unless the parties and the center and the arbitrators all have practical answers to those specific concerns, like having the camera that works, that looks the 360 camera or stuff like that, that actually has a specific answer. But that's just like,
maybe shifting then, if there are no other comments there, there was a query on the use of this phrase in our practice, rebus sic stantibus. For those who don't know what it is, it's where changed circumstances exist that prohibit the application of a treaty. And so have you seen this argument? The question goes, what are the consequences for this sort of treatment in emerging contract breaches, and how will they be addressed?
Rekha, if you want, I can provide a very general idea on this. This is a very interesting topic, Jaime, and thank you for your question or your comment. I just want to let you know that in Mexico, under Mexican law, the rebus sic stantibus clause is only applicable for civil contract. Under Mexican law, we have a difference between the civil contract and a commercial contract. So this theory won't be applicable in commercial cases so far. I mean, I don't know if after this pandemic, the courts, Mexican courts, will have to decide on this and interpret that probably this will be applicable for commercial cases. But so far, under Mexican law, the rebus sic stantibus is a theory only applicable to civil cases. So it won't be really an option for a company in a commercial relationship to raise. That's interesting. And also because it is regulated only in some states of the country, not in every local civil code. So we will need to take a look to the specific case and the place the contract was executed to determine whether this theory will be applicable or not. So in terms of arbitration, it's an argument or a theory that it's difficult to find, again, because it's not a part of the commercial discussion in an arbitration case, but only in civil cases.
Yes, maybe I can add something that of what Cecilia talked recently. I agree with her. I think we have to be waiting to some decisions in that way. But in arbitration cases, some arbitrators can't decide thinking in equity. So maybe there is a space to look in a different way the problems that are submitted in arbitration cases. But in civil law, different than commercial law in Chile as in Mexico, this clause is just for civil law. So I think we'll have to wait and see what the judiciary will tell about these different claims in these matters.
I'm going to take one final question that was posed, this idea of hybrid hearings, and Karima had touched upon it, but in general, conversations on due process as we move to hybrid and not just fully virtual. Any comments on the use of hybrid and how due process comes into the conversation and what's being done?
Thank you, Rekha. In my experience, what I've seen is that, I only participate in institutionalized arbitrations, but something very useful about institutions is that I have the perception that parties feel more safe or supported when the institution is present. So in my experience, for example, if the hearing is virtual and the platform is provided by the institutions, then parties agree more happily to participate. And we are planning a hearing for at the beginning of August, and the parties are deciding if either it's going to be a hybrid or online or whatever. But something that has been highlighted is that they want the institution to be participating somehow, either providing the platform or being there if the one party is going to be present with the arbitrator, that someone that represents the institution is also there, gives kind of trust to the procedure in the eyes of the parties. So that's what I've been noticing of parties' attitude regarding the participation of the institution.
Noting the time. It's 7:37, so I think what we'll do is conclude. There are some other questions that are being posited in the chat, and some of them will require perhaps their own programs. I note the one that just came through about where there's not an arbitration clause and the parties get hostile. I think as practitioners and institutional perspectives, we literally could take another panel on that, so allow us to think and stay tuned. But with that, what I wanted to say is not only thank you to our speakers for joining us, but really, you can't put on programs like these in a vacuum. We need an audience, and you all have just been engaging, thoughtful, and just along with us for the journey. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, from all of the institutions represented who supported us, in addition to the Inter-American Affairs Committee. It's been a pleasure. With that, I'm going to turn the floor back to Mike to close us out. Mr. Fernandez, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rekha. And I echo Pierre. Nice job, Rekha. Well done. This has been a fantastic dialogue, cross-regional dialogue that's been very informative. Thank you to the audience for all of your questions and for your active participation, which has only enriched this dialogue. And thank you to all the speakers. I as I said earlier, I mentioned this was a panel of all stars. I think they've proven it in spades. So thank you to the speakers. Thank you to Reka. Thanks to all of you for your active participation. And the speakers will collect the questions. The speakers will reach out, and we'll take under advisement some of these questions and whether to organize other panels. So we'll be on the lookout. So, thanks, everyone.